Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. And as this year comes to a close, we are looking back at some of the stories that dominated the news in 2013. Today, we will focus on gun violence in America following the massacre of schoolchildren in Connecticut that outraged the nation, yet no reforms followed, and gun massacres continue unabated. We begin with a broadcast of Background Briefing from January the 9th, 2013, and look into what the president, who deputized Joe Biden to take on the task of reducing gun violence in the country, can achieve in the face of a determined, organized, and well-funded opposition. Saul Cornell, the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, and The Second Amendment Goes to Court, joins us to discuss what could be achieved through executive order short of the American people standing up to the NRA. Then from April the 25th of 2013, we speak with Michael Cohen, who is a columnist for the UK Guardian and The Observer, where he has an article, Why Does America Lose Its Head Over Terror But Ignore Its Daily Gun Deaths? We will examine the paradox of our inordinate fear of random violence from terrorists compared to our acceptance of the daily death toll from guns and the preventable workplace deaths of 14 Americans every day, as well as to try and understand why 3,531 Americans, more than were killed on 9/11, have died from gun violence since Newtown. Yet a majority of Americans are not as motivated to do something about it, while the 1% who belong to the NRA are highly motivated to ensure that America's criminals and terrorists are the best armed in the world. Then finally, from December 8, 2013, on the one-year anniversary of the Newtown School Massacre, Amandeep Kalika joins us in the studio to discuss the lack of progress on gun control and legislation to reduce hate crimes and mass shootings. The son of the president of the Sikh temple, who was murdered along with five members of his congregation by a white supremacist, Amandeep Kalika, is running for Congress to unseat Representative Paul Ryan, in whose district his father was shot. And joining us now is Saul Cornell, who's the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect?, and the forthcoming book, The Second Amendment Goes to Court. He is the Paul and Diane Gunter Chair in American History at Fordham University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Saul Cornell.
Thank you for having me.
And Vice President Biden said today that President Obama is determined to curb gun violence in the United States, and the president will act. But is there anything that the president can do via executive order?
Well, that is an interesting question because, of course, Biden implied that there were things that could be done. There certainly are some things that fall within the executive branch's purview. The question is how much can they do unless they can get some kind of congressional authorization to empower ATF to do things that everyone says they ought to be able to do. Like currently, ATF is forbidden to do more than one surprise inspection a year. You know, you can imagine what would happen to the restaurants in Los Angeles if suddenly they knew that they only had to fear being inspected once. What would happen, you know, once that inspection had occurred? No one would really imagine that the quality of food being served in LA would be any safer. So that kind of thing, some of the regulations require congressional involvement, but there apparently are all kinds of absurdities in the way that ATF is hampered in terms of their ability to use computers to automate background checks. So there may well be some things that even without a congressional consensus, the executive branch might be able to improve the way they enforce gun laws.
Well, of course, the reason ATF is hobbled, and I spoke recently with a former ATF agent, is because of the Congress and because of the influence of the NRA over the Congress. They have the Tie-Hard Amendment, for example,
totally
ties their hands for all law enforcement, sharing data on crime guns. Now, the NRA...
Of course, isn't it great that the great champions of the Second Amendment don't seem to have as much respect for the First Amendment?
Well,
you know, they're trying to deport Pierce Morgan. They're preventing academic research on gun violence, and they have the Tie-Hard Amendment. It sort of speaks of a level of hypocrisy that's really unrivaled in American politics.
Well, but the hypocrisy, I think, the central hypocrisy of the NRA is that they say that they're protecting the rights of law-abiding citizens, when in fact the Tie-Hard Amendment is protecting the rights of criminals, because crime guns, guns used in crime, are already prima facie evidence of criminality. And the idea that data on these guns and who sold them, when, where, and how is not law enforcement is not able to share that data because of this congressional amendment put through by the NRA.
Well, I think that's an excellent point, and I think one of the things that we're seeing happening now, for really the first time that I can recall, is we've reached a sort of tipping point in American politics after the horror of what happened at Newtown. I think we've reached a point almost like we reached in the civil rights movement when those three civil rights workers were murdered, and suddenly the civil rights movement was not just a movement about African Americans. The civil rights movement was something that all Americans could feel connected to, and we're now at a moment, I think, where people who did not see the gun issue as their issue have finally said, you know, this is something that affects all of us. We have an obligation to protect our children, our communities. And I'm hearing from people all over the country that we're actually now in a different place. Whether that's enough to break the dysfunctionality and some of the perverse incentives in our political system remains to be seen. But for the first time, we're seeing the beginnings of a popular movement to try and restore some sanity to our public debate over guns. And we haven't really seen a grassroots movement like that before.
Again, I'm speaking with Saul Cornell, who's the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect?, and the forthcoming book, The Second Amendment Goes to Court. He is the Paul and Diane Gunter Chair in American History at Fordham University. You mentioned Piers Morgan of CNN and how there's a move afoot by supporters of the NRA and the so-called gun rights community to have him deported. Of course, his exchange on his program with Alex Jones has gone viral, and a lot of people have commented on it, and particularly on what a bizarre character Alex Jones is. And of course, he's a protege of the cult leader that went up in flames at Waco. He's also, by the way, the producer and financier of a film that the Pacifica Network has distributed called Loose Change, about the 9/11 conspiracy. And, you know, there are a lot of people clearly on the left in the Pacifica community who actually think that they're on the left when they support a rabid right-wing, paranoid, anti-government, poisonous, I better stop now. I mean, what's going on in our politics?
I mean, I've sometimes been surprised at the strange bedfellows gun rights makes. I mean, you do sometimes see in the gun rights community groups that would hardly align together, align behind gun rights. So, you know, you get former Black Panthers and KKK members, each affirming a fairly aggressive interpretation of gun rights. It's a peculiarly bizarre American configuration of politics. But yes, the thing that I found most striking, I mean, obviously the insanity of it was what was probably most striking, but that there are, it's not just Alex Jones. You can actually go onto the National Review website and you can see people arguing that the purpose of the Second Amendment is to give us the right to overthrow our government, which is hard to reconcile with the fact that the Constitution only defines one crime, which is treason, which is defined as taking up arms against the government. So according to this bizarre theory of the Second Amendment seems to have repealed the treason clause of the Constitution, except nobody seems to have noticed that until the gun rights community made this rather bizarre claim.
Just elaborate on that a little bit, on the treason clause.
Well, the treason is defined in the Constitution as a crime that involves taking up arms against the government. And if you look at some of the gun rights rhetoric, where they talk about Second Amendment solutions to political problems, they talk about needing guns, things like adapted military weapons like AR-15s. They need them because they need to be able to take on the government. That's really hard to reconcile with the fact that treason is a crime that's defined by the Constitution. Also hard to reconcile with the fact that at the time of the American Revolution, most of the states imposed loyalty oaths, which required you to swear an loyalty oath to the new state governments or be disarmed. So obviously the founders were not against disarming people who were making claims that they were going to take up arms against the government. And then there's the fact that the Constitution itself is at least in part a response to Shays' Rebellion, where farmers decided unilaterally that they could create their own militias and take up arms against the government. The founding fathers were not the people who supported Daniel Shays. They were the people who sent in troops to put down the rebellion. So we get this funny thing in the debate over the Second Amendment and gun rights where historical reality is almost inverted. And the version that you find in sort of popular gun rights ideology is almost the mirror image of the historical reality.
Well, indeed, it is turning history on its head to believe, as the so-called gun rights community does, that the Second Amendment is about their right to protect themselves from their own government, when, in fact, if anybody studies American history, particularly Tom Paine and others who talked about summer soldiers and sunshine patriots, what was happening was that George Washington and company were giving out guns to their recruits, and a lot of them were the summer soldiers and sunshine patriots who just wandered off with the guns. That's why they wanted a well-regulated militia. The government didn't want to be in the business of proliferating firearms to people who showed up sensibly to fight the British but then wandered off when it suited them.
Well, the thing that's really bizarre from my point of view is to hear someone like Senator Ted Cruz say that the idea of registration is a violation of the Second Amendment. He obviously hasn't encountered George Washington, who proposed in 1783 that we create a national militia muster roll and put everyone's name on it who is eligible to bear arms and inspect their weapons twice a year. Obviously, Senator Cruz hasn't studied enough American history to know that his interpretation of the Second Amendment, if it had been operationalized in 1776, we would have lost the American Revolution, because we wouldn't have been able to muster a well-regulated militia unless we knew who was in it, what kind of weapons they had, the quality of the weapons, whether they had been properly trained with them. So the whole idea that the Second Amendment is some barrier to all kinds of common-sense regulations, including registration, if we decide that that's a good policy, and there's a lot of reasons to think it is a good policy, the idea that that could somehow be unconstitutional just reveals a level of ignorance of American history and basic constitutional law that's shocking for someone like Cruz to be spouting on Fox News or on the NewsHour.
So, Saul Cornell, Vice President Biden on Wednesday met with some of the people who have advocated gun control. And, of course, we did have an assault weapons ban for 10 years. They put a sunset clause in it, and George W. Bush refused to renew it. And Senator Feinstein, who was responsible for the original assault weapons ban, is going to reintroduce it. But the vice president met with the Brady campaign and other groups opposed to the proliferation of guns and particularly military-style weapons, along with the victims of the massacres at Virginia Tech and at survivors also of Aurora, Colorado, and the attorney general. And then Thursday, he meets with the NRA, and apparently the biggest seller of guns in the country, Walmart, initially didn't want to attend the meeting, but then they've changed their mind. So they are apparently going to show up on Thursday to meet with the vice president. We talked about what the president might be able to do in terms of an executive order, in terms of taking the handcuffs off the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosive Agency, which used to be with the Treasury, is now with the Justice Department. It hasn't had a leader for the last 6 years. So what about public opinion? The thing that I find extraordinary about this is that clearly there's no lobby, a counter-lobby against the NRA. But if you look at the numbers of the NRA, they only have about 4 million members. That really makes them the 1% in terms of America's population. So is their bark worse than their bite? Is there enough people out there in the 99% to suddenly stand up? I know after these massacres, people are much more motivated and then the energy seems to dissipate. But it would seem to me that they're happening so frequently, these massacres, that this is something I think that you simply, as a culture, as a people, as a country, we can't sweep under the rug anymore.
Well, I think that the money that the NRA has certainly has helped it, and it's important to recognize that every time you buy a firearms, you know, for instance, Sturm Ruger here in Connecticut donates a dollar to the NRA. So the NRA is not just a representative of gun owners; it's also a representative of the gun industry. And of course, we haven't had a peace industry to counter it in quite the same way. But I think the key is that after Newtown, there seems to be for the first time an upwelling, a grassroots movement of people who are really frustrated and who feel like we're not doing enough and who feel like there are enough things that are so obvious that need to be done that most gun owners support, that even in some cases most NRA members support, like expanding background checks so that everyone who gets a firearm is legally entitled to one, no matter where they buy it from, unless it's some back alley channel, and there you get into sort of policing issues as opposed to regulations of sales. But there's no question that there now is a belief that we have to make this an issue that we're all willing to show up to a legislative hearing in our state capitol. One of the reasons the NRA has been so successful is they've been able to turn out the vote. They have a very loyal, zealous membership. There are other even more zealous gun groups that make the NRA look somewhat moderate, which is, of course, hard to believe, but true. And until we have soccer moms and grandparents and soccer coaches all showing up to counter those people who will be at the legislative hearings, we won't really see change. But I think for the first time, I'm hearing a lot of people say, if I have to take a day off from work to make my school safer, I'm going to do it. So I think we're starting to see spontaneous popular interest in this issue. And if that popular movement can be channeled, we may well see some major legislative changes.
Perhaps we should reverse the NRA's call to put armed militia in schools and put teachers in gun stores.
Well, that's kind of an interesting suggestion. I mean, one of the problems I think we have in this debate is also that the NRA and the gun rights community have been very effective at staying on point and at articulating a message that fits on a bumper sticker. One of the problems is the people who favor sensible gun regulation. The very term sensible gun regulation obviously does not work as effectively as a soundbite as, when guns are outlawed, only outlawers will have guns. So I think there is a real challenge to articulate a message that people can rally around and to set an agenda that people can commit themselves to. And I think there's also no question that, I was listening to some mothers talk today about the experience of being in a school during a lockdown. I think as more and more people actually know someone who goes through that experience and how traumatizing it is for these kids, I live not far from Newtown, and there was someone walking with an umbrella near the train station who was wearing, black jeans and maybe a dark windbreaker or something, and the whole school went into lockdown. The whole school district went into lockdown. In fact, the two towns, because this happened in between the two towns, went into lockdown. And you've got to understand that herding kids into a closet and having them stay quiet, not knowing whether there's another Newtown shooter on the loose. I mean, this is starting to be something that everyone in America is being touched by. It's a shame that when these kinds of everyday shootings were occurring in some of our urban areas, there wasn't the same outcry. But now that other people realize, everyone is affected by gun violence, not just people living in urban areas, I think now there is going to be a change. How much of a change still remains to be seen, but there's enormous popularity for some of these measures. There's enormous popularity for background checks. Most gun owners believe in safe storage, so why can't we enact a series of laws that encourage everyone to do what smart gun owners already do? I mean, the place we get to the most conflict is obviously when you begin to start banning certain kinds of weapons. But we're even hearing a much more aggressive discussion around whether or not everyone who wants to have an AR-15 should just be able to walk into the local Walmart, or even worse, walk into the gun show without a background check and just walk out with one. I think that is starting to be troubling to people.
Well, Saul Cornell, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Saul Cornhill, who's the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect, and the forthcoming book, The Second Amendment Goes to Court. He is the Paul and Diane Gunter Chair of American History at Fordham University. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with a broadcast from April the 25th, 2013, about why Americans fear terrorism but ignore the daily gun deaths. It's like the sun. You see the best of me when I have got my gun. I'm gonna get me a gun. I'm gonna get me a gun. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Cohen, who's a fellow at the Century Foundation and a regular columnist at The Guardian of the UK and The Observer. He is the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America. Previously served in the United States Department of State as the chief speechwriter for the United States representative to the United Nations, and has also worked at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His latest article at the UK Guardian and The Observer is Why Does America Lose Its Head Over Terror But Ignore Its Daily Gun Deaths? Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Cohen.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And it is extraordinary that a couple of losers with pressure cookers shut down a major American city for almost a week. The entire country was glued to cable news. And it is, as you point out in your article, it's surreal and difficult to explain that Americans place an inordinate fear on violence that is random and unexplained, that can be blamed on others like jihadists and terrorists and evildoers, etc., but lurking dangers all around us, from guns, our unhealthy diets, the workplace that kills 14 Americans every single day, they're just accepted as part of life, the price of freedom. I'm quoting you.
So thank you.
I'm sure you agree with it.
I very much do agree with it, yes, absolutely. Look, you know, it's I don't have a good explanation for it, and I think the best explanation I can come up with is that we tend to place disproportionate fear on that which seems more random and more unusual and more rare. You know, we've been very lucky in this country that we haven't experienced a great many terrorist attacks. This is a good thing. I would hate for us to become more inert to these types of attacks. But I think part of the consequences of that is that we tend to respond. I think we tend to overreact more in our responses to these attacks than we do other sorts of violence that we kind of take for granted. So I think that's a lot to do with it. And I think that, you know, when these types of attacks get hyped up, when you have cable news running sort of breathless, you know, breaking news all day on it, when you have, you know, politicians talking about, you know, suspending the Constitution, it tends to inflate people's concerns and their fears. And I think that's a lot of what's happened around this particular incident, you know, which was tragic. I don't want to minimize the tragedy of it. It was a horrible attack, and certainly it was terrorizing to a lot of people in Boston and I think around the country. But we need to put this stuff in perspective. This is one of the very few terrorist attacks we've had on American soil since 9/11. And, you know, we are very much not threatened by terrorists, and particularly these two. You know, I find it sort of incredible that this 19-year-old kid who, you know, police I think knew was wounded, was on foot, that they would shut down a whole American city to find him just seems, you know, it's just kind of crazy. I can't imagine that kind of reaction to any other violent incident.
And, of course, this whole incident took place on the very day that the Senate shut down a very modest gun control bill that would improve background checks. And even though the Democrats were able to pass it by a majority because of the arbitrary 60-vote filibuster thresholds that the Republicans have imposed in a complete political usurpation, which is mystifying in itself, that they can get away with it, the irony is that these guys were pretty well armed, weren't they? And they had explosives, and the NRA seems to be determined that America's criminals are the best armed in the world. And indeed, explosives cannot be tagged because the NRA prevented the ATF from having manufacturers of explosives put tags in. So there's something surreal going on here.
Very much, yeah. It's surreal. And I'll tell you something else, too. I mean, what you hear, and I heard this, from a few Republicans, was, you know, criminals won't, you know, they won't abide by background checks, right? They won't buy their guns, you know, if they know the background check, so they won't work. But, I mean, that's exactly the point, isn't it? The point is to prevent criminals from buying guns in the first place and to make it harder for them to do that. And it's such a strange thing that you know, the background check that was being proposed was rather, you know, I think pretty minor. I mean, it basically, you know, sort of closed the gun show loophole. It would have made it harder for people who have mental illness, harder their criminal record, to buy a gun. I don't know the story of whether these two brothers up in Boston had a hard time buying a gun, but certainly one of them had been, you know, convicted of a domestic violence attack. It might have been harder for him to buy a gun because of this, if there was a background check in place. It just seems that this is a rather small inconvenience to ask of gun purchasers in order to keep guns out of the hands of potential criminals or potential, you know, violent offenders. But again, you know, it gets portrayed as some sort of infringement on liberty and our freedom, and thus it can't become a law. And yet at the same time, I mean, what I find sort of crazy, at the same time, many Bostonians willingly accepted the idea of staying in their homes all day long because their governor told them they had to, because there was a threat. You know, there wasn't. I've yet to see really good evidence for why that lockdown was necessary, and yet Americans, you know, were easily cowed into basically abiding by this sort of arbitrary order from the police.
But the irony is, of course, Michael Cohen, is that the minute that they lifted that embargo on people getting out of their homes, this guy went out of his home and found the terrorist on the loose. So,
absolutely.
I mean, yeah. It would have been better off engaging Bostonians in the hunt rather than having holed up, cowering under their beds. Now, just again to quote your article here, on the same day of the marathon bombing in Boston, 11 Americans were murdered. The pregnant Breshawna Jackson was killed in Dallas, allegedly by a boyfriend. In Richmond, California, James Tucker III was shot and killed while riding his bicycle. Assailants unknown. Nigel Hardy, a 13-year-old boy in Palmdale, California, who was being bullied at school, took his own life. He used the gun that his father kept at home. And in Brooklyn, New York, an off-duty police officer used her department-issued Glock 9mm handgun to kill herself, her boyfriend, and her one-year-old child. That's just one day in America. Now, in the past four months, there have been 3,531 Americans killed by guns, and which total that, of course, surpasses the numbers of Americans killed on 9/11. So, again, I feel like I'm in the alternative universe. These rational arguments, they obviously don't matter to followers of the NRA, but at what point are they going to matter to the majority of Americans, and so that they can get fired up as much as the NRA people are fired up? You know, if they've 90% support background checks, maybe 90% of Americans ought to start voting and getting politically active. Because if there are only 4 million members of the NRA, that's 1% of the population. So you're really down to the 1% versus the 90%.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have a problem here where people who care about this issue and vote on this issue, vote exclusively on this issue, are people who are supporters of the NRA and people who are who are anti-gun control. So, you know, there just has not been at any point in this country a real groundswell among Americans to sort of to push some of these gun control measures. I mean, I think there's nominal support for them. I mean, the background checks had about 90% support. But it doesn't seem to be an issue that gets people, you know, rallies them, and it's not a single issue for people. You know, they're not going to vote exclusively on the gun issue. And I think it's also a difference, by the way, in states. I mean, I live in New York, and you'd be hard-pressed to find any politician in the state who would be anti-gun control, you know, be pro-NRA. You know, that's why we have, actually, in New York, one of the toughest gun laws in the country. But if you go to, you know, the Deep South, if you go to the Far West, you're going to have a much different point of view on this. I think it has a lot to do with the problem, is that you rarely have a situation in which you have sort of a pro-gun, you know, pro-gun control versus anti-gun control candidate. But I think in general, you know, the NRA has made themselves up into a very powerful organization. And, you know, their imprimatur for candidates matters. That's why you saw so many Democrats. I mean, you saw four Democrats who didn't vote for the bill, who voted against the background checks. And I think for a lot of Republicans, they just see no political benefit in supporting this, in upsetting a key constituency of theirs. So I don't know how this changes. I mean, maybe this vote in the Senate was the first step in a long, drawn-out process of making gun control more palatable to Americans, and maybe outraging enough Americans that they're going to do something about it. But this isn't going to happen overnight. And as you suggested, it's going to take a lot of people getting a lot angrier and voting on this issue. But, you know, you're talking maybe years down the road before this has a real impact. And in the meantime, I mean, how many Americans needlessly have to die before the stranglehold of the NRA is broken? I mean, this is what I find, you know, so tragic. I mean, as you mentioned those numbers, since Newtown, I mean, this is 4 months, we've lost more Americans than we lost on 9/11 from gun violence. That is a stunningly high number. And part of the reason it is so high, not the only reason, part of the reason it's so high is because of the easy availability of guns and people's ability to purchase them. And that's, you know, there's a reason why we have the highest level of gun violence in the world. And that's a big part of it.
Well, but today, two key senators, Charles Schumer and John McCain, came out saying that this legislation will come back before the end of the year as public attitudes shift towards stricter controls. And Kelly Ayotte is being targeted. She's the New Hampshire senator whose poll numbers have dropped precipitously because there's been pushback in the local press about her vote. And also the Mitch McConnell, he's being targeted. Both Ayotte and McConnell are being targeted by Gabby Giffords' group, Americans for Responsible Solutions. They're going to be running ads trying to give them some political payback. So there's an indication that there might be a backlash in terms of a political movement here, a pushback against the NRA. And if Mayor Bloomberg, with unlimited funds, could fund a lot of this stuff in the 2014 elections, maybe it could become an issue. It seems to me that at some point or other, progressives and liberals in this country have got to stop expecting to lose and decide to win for a change, because I guarantee you the NRA guys, they're determined to win.
Well, here's why there is some reason, I think, for optimism, and it's a small reason, but nonetheless a reason. You have, I think, after this vote, you have you have greater support for gun control measures than you did pre-Newtown. And I think there is actually among Democrats less fear about running on the gun issue. Now, that's not true in every state. You know, Mark Pryor is not going to, in Arkansas, and Mark Begich in Alaska are not going to be running on these issues. But I think for a lot of Democrats, there is going to be more, let's say less reluctance to sort of talk about this issue. And I think even on the presidential level. And in a way, it could become an issue that is a dividing line between Democrats and Republicans that actually helps Democrats. There's no question that in red states, this is a major, major issue. But I think if you can see a blue state Democrats running on this issue and profiting from it, I mean, politically profiting from it, then I think you have a possibility for change. And Kelly Ayotte's an interesting example. You know, if she loses her Senate race, and, you know, the sense of it is because of her position on gun control, that will spark change. And you will have Republicans in perhaps, less red states or bluer states or purple states who might say, I have to get ahead of this issue and I can't be just, you know, towing the NRA line. That's how this change happens. But, you know how politicians are, unfortunately. Until they see, you know, somebody lose because of it, I'm not so sure you're going to see a real shift happen. And for a lot of Democrats, they remember 1994 that a lot of red state Dems lost because of their vote on the assault weapons ban. And that is something that has resonated for a lot of Democrats since then. Again, it's a process. And the only hope you can take out of this experience is that what happened in the Senate last week begins that process of Democrats being more aggressive on the issue and Republicans being more defensive on the issue and voters caring about the issue. I mean, you know, again, I care about this issue passionately, but I live in a state in which, you know, my congressmen and senators and governors, you know, they all take my position on this issue. So it's harder for, I think, those in blue states to have their voices heard. But I think when you have more people in swing states who are upset about this, then maybe it has an impact, and hopefully it will.
Well, but there's got to be more urban. There are more urban people than rural people, and obviously in the Senate, it's stacked in favor of these small states, the red states, because they get two per state, and California with 38 million people going to get two, and Wyoming with, what, 760,000 or something ridiculous, you know, but one congressional district, you know,
yeah.
And the same with Alaska, one congressional district, they get two votes. We know about that. But the rural states can hoard the guns, but the guns are used in urban states, and you've got a lot of soccer bums out there. You've got a lot of mayhem going on in Chicago and other cities. I know they vote Democrat by and large, but the suburbs more and more, I think, surely would impact. I just have a feeling that the numbers are on the side of change. It's just a question of motivation.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's a question of whether you can get people to vote on this issue and to vote against someone who is on the wrong side of this issue. And, you know, until you see it actually happen, I mean, New Hampshire could be a test case for it, but until you see it actually happen, I don't think you're going to see any change. I hate to say that, but until politicians feel this is an issue that hurts them. I mean, look at immigration as a perfect example of this. You know, Republicans didn't want to do anything in immigration the past couple of years, and suddenly they do, and it's because they think it cost them the 2012 election. It didn't, but that's what they think. And so they think they have to be on the right side of expanding voters, and this is the way to do it. So when the political calculation changes, that's when you'll see change in this issue. It hasn't happened yet, and there are too many counterexamples of people, you know, losing or becoming more vulnerable because of the position on guns than being sort of, you know, pro gun control, than people being hurt because they're anti gun control. And until that happens, I just politicians aren't going to make the change you want to see. Ultimately, the real impetus will come from the ballot box. It won't come from public opinion.
Well, just in closing, Michael Cohen, since we're talking about the surreal, which is unfortunately real in this country, the five living presidents are in Dallas today in the inauguration of George W. Bush Presidential Library. And what I find extraordinary now is that Fox pundits and a number of congressional Republicans are now saying, and Dana Perino and others, it's all the same talking points. You know, the mill turns this stuff out, and it sort of goes from the pundits to Fox to the think tanks to Fox to the talking heads, and around it goes, all in unison now they're beginning to chant Krauthammer and et al. Are all saying Bush kept us safe and Obama didn't. Bush kept us safe, and look what happened under Obama. We have terrorist attacks. As though 9/11 never happened. I mean, what do you do? Is it really a case that we are in an alternative universe and facts don't matter, at least with these people?
I have to say my favorite talking point was that was somebody arguing that after 9/11 that there were no terrorist attacks on American soil. I mean, you know, 9/11 seems like a relevant data point as far as you want to assess the Bush presidency on terrorism. I think the efforts of the Bush apologists are not going to succeed, largely because I think people's views about Bush are pretty solid. You saw this one poll that claimed 47% approval, which actually is not unusual. The presidents often look better in the rearview mirror. That number is still pretty low. I've seen other numbers that are even lower. But, I mean, I go back to polls you saw last year, which they asked Americans, who do you blame for the economic crisis? And overwhelmingly, it was Bush and not Obama. I think those talking points you're referring to, I mean, they exist. They are repellent, frankly. But they, I think, appeal to narrow partisans. I don't think many Americans are looking back on George Bush's presidency and saying, yeah, it wasn't so bad. I think it's, you know, generally understood to have been an unmitigated disaster, and I think, you know, I'd be very surprised that changed anytime soon.
Well, Michael Cohen,
look, anything's possible, right?
Sure.
I mean, I guess it could happen, but I remain, on this one, I remain at least somewhat confident that people will continue to view Bush's presidency as the disaster that it was.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Michael Cohen.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Cohen, who's a fellow at the Century Foundation and a regular columnist at The Guardian of the UK and The Observer. He is the author of Life and the Campaign Trail, the greatest presidential campaign speeches of the 20th century and how they shaped modern America. Previously served in the United States Department of State as chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative to the United Nations and also worked at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His latest article at the UK Guardian and The Observer is Why Does America Lose Its Head Over Terror But Ignore Its Daily Gun Deaths? We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back with a program from December 8th, 2013, with the son of the president of the Sikh temple, who was murdered in a gun massacre by a white supremacist. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining me in the studio now is Amardeep Kaleka, who is an Emmy Award-winning film director who, following his father's murder in the Wisconsin Sikh temple shooting of 2012, became involved in gun control and new legislation to reduce hate crimes. He is running for the United States House of Representatives in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District to unseat Representative Paul Ryan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amardeep Kaleka.
Thank you, Ian, for having me.
And, of course, your father was slain at the Oak Creek Temple in Wisconsin, and along with five others of his congregation, in a mass shooting by a white supremacist on August the 12th of 2012. And also this white supremacist, when the police arrived, he shot a police officer 15 times. He survived, I take it, the policeman.
He did. Lieutenant Brian Murphy survived, and my father had a hard-fought battle with the gunman with a little bit of a fruit knife, and he fought him off, and the gunman left immediately after that battle and didn't shoot anybody else except for Lieutenant Brian Murphy and then himself.
So, your father's probably saved the lives of a lot of congregants, right?
We think so. We hope so.
Right. But since then, we've had other mass shootings. Of course, this is the one-year anniversary of the Newtown School massacre. It must be hard for you to get your head around the idea of why does this keep happening? And in spite of the outpourings of anguish every time it happens, the whole nation is outraged, and yet nothing is done. So what's your understanding of that disconnect?
Well, it's complex. Immediately following August 5th, I went into intense meditation and thinking about this process, and then Sandy Hook happened, and we were asked to come out there and then be part of a coalition of survivors from Columbine, Virginia Tech, Sandy Hook, all our friends now, and we've become a family that most often you don't want to have a family like that. We always say it's the family you don't want to have. But over the past year now, we've done a documentary called Peacemakers, where we follow each of these people from these different tragedies, and we allow them to analyze why America has become so insanely violent. And the violence is different. It's not bred from just economic disparity. Like in these situations in America where we're a highly developed nation, it's bred on hate. On racism, on hate, on classism, on, you know, conspiracy theories gone wrong, whatever the case right. may be.
Yeah. Well, of course, and conspiracy theories exist on both the left and the right. And this idiot shooter, the white supremacist, thought that somehow because Sikhs wear turbans, they were, what, the Ayatollah or something? What can you figure out there?
But I can give you a couple of things. He was a former Army sergeant, was mm-hmm. let go. So I think he did know the difference between Muslims and Sikhs. But there is that cross discrepancy or, you know, maybe he was confused, but I think he was trying to start a race war. That's essentially what his lyrics and his music state.
I see.
And he thought to himself, well, let's attack the Sikhs because they're so militant and they've fought in so many gallantly in so many wars. Hmm. So what if we attack them? They're going to attack us and then we start this race war. But instead, what we decided to do was turn the other cheek in a very Christian way and say, hey, let's work towards peace.
And this started you on a journey into politics, right?
Yeah.
You're a filmmaker, right?
Absolutely. After that documentary, I came to face-to-face with a number of congressmen, number of senators, and started to realize that the problem is far deeper than meets the eye. It's systemic. It's the governance of our whole nation. It's the idea that people become bipartisan and push far left or push far right, and then there's no middle ground, and people are battling even rhetorically on the Hill and shutting down the government, which affects all of us economically, but they don't have to live with it. They don't have to go to the inner city. We come from the inner city. They don't have to go there. And so that's what launched me into this idea or thought process of maybe running for a seat. And then I was asked several times for a state assembly seat from both sides. And I just thought to myself, I would rather do something nationally. And that's the seat came about. It could be one of the 17 that gets flipped. Originally, it was not thought to be.
You're talking about Congressman Paul Ryan's seat.
Yeah. Originally, it wasn't thought to be a flippable seat.
Right.
But in the R3 region, when the polling came back, people started looking at it and saying, well, if it's only 3 percentage points lead to a Republican, and other ones are 5, 10, 12, mm-hmm. I mean, who can we put there? And who can run this? And I raised my hand a couple of times.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the very polarity and dysfunction from partisanship and ultra-partisanship is manifested in the primary system. And, you know, if you're a Democrat, then in a curious way, the best thing that happened to the Democrats is the civil war within the Republicans between the Tea Party and the traditional Republicans, and it plays out in the primary process. How but you're entering that very same primary process on the Democratic side, right?
I am.
And what's your sense then of how you, as you're not white.
I'll be the first.
You're not Christian. You're not a gun-toting deer hunter. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Mm. Most people in Wisconsin are. I'm just trying to paint a picture here of an uphill battle.
Oh, no, it's definitely uphill. We are hunters. We hunt tigers in India, and we hunt deer in India, like our ancestry. So we're very well versed in guns, and coming from an Army ROTC background where they would make me the point man with my M16, I had some training, you know. And so I'm not gun-toting, let's say that. And, of course, I've fought for gun legislation, which I think every American should fight for, because illegal guns are what we're all fighting, right?
And well, also the intersection between mentally ill people and easy access to firearms. That
absolutely.
That is the pathology, the diagnosis behind all of these mass shootings, almost
absolutely.
Without exception, you find, at the end of the day, that's what you find it's about. And,
absolutely.
And that is one of these most outrageous things that the NRA are blocking.
It seems to be because everybody thinks there's a slippery slope on legislation, where if you just pass one, it's going to change everything. But I venture to show people, and the American government is not moving that fast on anything. Let's look at, pro-life versus pro-choice. It takes us 40 years, Roe versus Wade afterwards, and we're still arguing the same thing. Nothing is going to slip and change that fast. It is an uphill battle in the primary and in the general in Wisconsin District 1, because you're right, I'll be the first person that's not white to even run in that district. I'll be, though we're very religious, I'm not Christian. Mm-hmm. And candidates usually, especially Paul Ryan, that's what he does. He can speak at pulpits. He can speak.
He does, and he claims to be a very devout Catholic. At the same time, I've interviewed Sister Simone Campbell, who led the nuns on the bus, who went to his district office and said, "How can you be a good Catholic and believe in Ayn Rand's peculiar Darwinian philosophy?"
I agree. I think. Whenever I talk to Christians, I quote, Samuel 1, chapter 17 of David and Goliath. And it seems to be all of us as Americans are in this situation where Goliath is, at that time with the Philistines, the Goliath was a 7-foot guy. For us, Goliath is all these negative things that are coming out of all our society, and whether it be warring or the, prison system, how tough it's gotten, whether it be a lack of education or trying to focus on it. But essentially, I believe that all of us as Americans need the David to come in the room, and that would be the people. We need the people to be represented in Congress. And that seems to be the missing aspect right now.
Well, isn't that largely because the Congress has been taken over by money?
You know, it's largely because
you're going to have to raise money, right?
I'm going to have to raise a lot. He's already sitting on probably $2 million around there from just the last campaign.
$70,000 plus from the Koch brothers.
Oh, yeah, the Koch brothers, the Koch brothers. So the money, you got to think of it like this. In 1972, the middle class made a certain amount of money. Now, 2012, we all know the middle class is making less and less money when you take into all these accounts, the inflation rate, the healthcare costs, everything else. We're making far less than we ever have been. Essentially, then, campaign finance has skyrocketed. So how can somebody from the middle class actually go to Congress to represent that idea? So trade unions are going to be attacked, which they are, especially in Wisconsin. Education is going to be attacked because who uses education? Who uses public education? I'm a product of public education. We grew up in the inner city and we were given government housing and we got, you know, free lunch and we got a little bit of welfare support. And these middle class ideals, which equal and level the playing field, that's what we need to protect.
So we started out, of course, talking about Nelson Mandela, who, you know, can't turn on the television or hear the radio without eulogies, which all of which are well-deserved. But there was, of course, an interesting role for South Africans of Indian descent, not the least of which was the Gandhi himself. And they were under that kind of Nazi system of apartheid. They were in the colored category. And then, of course, when the South African government started to trade a lot with Japan and they had to figure out were the Japanese white or colored. So they decided that the Japanese were white, but the Chinese were colored.
That was the dividing line. I was just in South Africa, I think, 2 years ago. And Mandiba, I went to Soweto and I went to go, see his house. And it brings you shivers to see how middle class and lower class he was, but how powerful he became after such a long battle. And the Gandhi connection is very apt, and not many people do know that he studied law school and became a lawyer in South Africa and then moved back to India. And with this idea, where he saw the racism and the apartheid movement and thought of it, oh my God, it's India. It's a mirror. Mm-hmm. And that same classism, racism still exists all around our nation or all around our planet in different ways, you know. So Mandiba, like Mandela, he's, to this day, like when you go to South Africa and you see those big statues of him, I mean, he's larger than life. Mm-hmm. And though he's died, I think he'll live on in all of our practices.
And again, I'm joined in the studio by Amardeep Kaleka, who is an Emmy Award-winning film director who, following his father's murder at the Wisconsin Sikh Temple in 2012, became involved in gun control and new legislation, and he's running for the United States House of Representatives to unseat Representative Paul Ryan in Wisconsin's 1st District. Back to the issue of gun control in the last couple of minutes here, Amar, tell me, this is talk about an uphill battle. I mean, you had all of that momentum. The president was told not to go near it. The Democrats had decided not to touch this issue. Yet President Obama was so deeply upset by what happened to those school children that he felt he couldn't remain silent and really stuck his neck out, pushed it as hard as he could, and yet it went down. And it shows you that how much money and minority rule actually operates in the U.S. Democracy.
Absolutely. The NRA grading system. We just put an introduction out to Wayne LaPierre just so we can go skeet shooting together, because there's this discussion. It's not a black or white issue. It seems like when you're bipartisan, everything is black and white. And people say that the gun legislation was the tipping point. That's the button that pushed the government shutdown, because then everybody looked at each other at such a critical junction of the Constitution, and then they wouldn't cross over on sides. Now, with gun legislation, I mean, as Sandy Hook's one-year anniversary approaches, and they're going to have a big event in D.C. Coming up for it, as it approaches, I think we all need to understand and comprehend we're fighting illegal guns. Nobody is fighting to take the guns out of legal hands. We understand if you live, you know, 100 miles away from another city and you have to protect your land, that's different. You've probably have, you know, filed the proper paperwork and done everything.
But let's face it, you don't need to protect your land in the 21st century. I mean, indeed, when Native Americans were massacred, arguably there were other ways to deal with that. The white people were actually stealing the land. But, you know, I mean, that's the part of it that I want to get a handle on this. And since I come from a different culture, where in Australia, you know, if manly men get into a fight, the last thing they do is pull out a gun. It's considered the most abject act of cowardice.
Absolutely.
Why is it in our culture that guns are considered heroic and manly and a way to settle problems?
Simple. Military-industrial complex. This nation was founded 200 years ago on warring and building guns and selling them and selling cannons and tanks and all these things. And the gun sales, capitalism in general, me and you both know if you plant a seed of certain capitalistic, let's say, invention, if it's a bicycle or if it's a car, it's going to grow. And so America, because it founded the idea or the usage of this many guns, you know, to fight, let's say, the Native Americans or fight different colonial rule or these types of things.
And then, of course, the Maxim machine gun was invented in America, the Gatling gun.
The Gatling, yeah. And there's guns that we will never see, you and I, you know, Department of Defense guns that you and I will never even touch or even hear about that get sold to a faraway nation. And that simple thing can be curbed by Congress, can be curbed by D.C., because it's our money, it's our taxpayer money that goes there.
But what about the psychological aspect? What about changing the young boys? And the movie industry here is culpable. And so is the television business in terms of every TV series is just endless guns and these silly little women holding big guns that supposedly be FBI officers.
Well, just remember that, you know, even when people product place Coca-Cola, there is a certain amount of influence in Hollywood from people who have money that are gun salesmen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and sometimes that's our own government. Sometimes that's just capitalistic people who are quite intelligent at making money.
I see. Well, that's true. The NRA is actually the lobbying group for the arms and ammunition manufacturers.
I'm glad you said it. I couldn't.
Well, you better. I mean, you got to win over those deer hunters.
Yeah, well, I love deer hunting. So we're gonna go after. We're gonna do some skeet shooting tournaments and definitely go after some deer.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Amardeep Kaleka, who is an Emmy Award-winning film director who, following his father's murder in the Wisconsin Sikh temple shooting of 2012, became involved in gun control and new legislation to reduce hate crimes. He is running for the United States House of Representatives in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District to unseat Representative Paul Ryan. This has been a special compilation of Background Briefing from 2013. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.